We're delighted to have the Reverend Dr. Guy Sales, pastor of First Baptist Church of Asheville, North Carolina, with us on this Day One Podcast Extra. Welcome, Guy.
Peter, thank you. It's good to be with you.
I'd like to understand your background a little better. How did you decide to go to seminary?
Well, there's the longer version and there's the shorter version. The shorter version is I had grown up as a Christian in a Baptist home and had early on sensed a calling to ministry. Lost track of that during my adolescent years. Went to college intending to go to law school. When I got my faith back, or my faith got me back during those college years, an early sense of a call to ministry came back, and I was redirected primarily by teachers at the college. So I went to seminary intending to be a teacher. I thought my vocation would be to teach in a college or seminary, since those were the people who had most recently helped me.
And you went to seminary?
I went to Southern Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky.
And while there, you served a Christian church, Disciples of Christ, right, as your student pastor.
Right.
How did that inform your ministry?
Well, Disciples of Christ and Baptist are cousins, and many disciples' churches came out of Baptist churches in the 19th century. So in terms of belief and practice and polity, they're very similar to each other. But the Christian church, Disciples of Christ, in very wonderful ways shaped me in an understanding of worship. They participate, they observe communion every Sunday. And so for those 3.5 years, I got to have that experience, and it placed communion, the Eucharist, at the heart of my understanding of spirituality and of worship. And they have also been a very ecumenical group of people. So it kept me alert to the opportunities to relate to Christians beyond my own normal boundaries.
I'm curious as to who some of your heroes in preaching or theology are.
Well, early on, as far as preachers go, early on, I was helped a great deal by Harry Emerson Fosdick, the Baptist who was the pastor at Riverside Church in New York City. I have great admiration and respect for and have learned a lot from Carlisle Marney. In terms of theologians, I go back again and again to E.Y. Mullins, an old Baptist theologian that you may or may not have heard of. But more recently, I've been helped a great deal by Douglas John Hall, who is a Canadian Reformed theologian.
I'd like to step back and take a look at the mainline church. And out of your experience as a pastor in the Baptist churches, what are the top one or two issues you think the church must address, the biggest struggles pastors like you are facing?
Well, I really think that the biggest issues we're facing are not the issues that grab the headlines. Issues of sexuality and ordination, even War and Peace, as crucial as that is, tend to grab the headlines, and they're vitally important issues. But I think underneath and often informing and deforming in some ways our approach to those issues are the challenges of materialism, consumerism. I think the challenge of kind of radicalized individualism, that we are on our own and alone, and some people experience that as a liberation and some as a fear. But in either case, I think it's a real challenge to us. And I think this is a paradoxical term on purpose. I think absolute relativism, the idea that there isn't any truth except the truth that there isn't any truth, I think those things challenge us and affect our ability to respond to the issues that are, in fact, in the headlines.
On our regular program, we talked a bit about your church's mission statement, and I'm wondering how your church came up with that statement. What was the process?
Well, when I got to the church, they had been involved during the interim time and at the close of the last pastor's work there, in an intensive congregational self-study. So I was able to take much of the work that had been done in that congregational self-study and work with a cross-section of the church's leaders to try to put into words what they had been discovering about the church's heritage and about the church's future. And that statement really is as much a statement of our hope for our mission as it is a description of the current reality of our mission.
You do some consulting with churches in covenant issues such as congregational identity, mission, leadership. How does that work?
Well, for me, the idea of covenant, the idea that communities of faith are bound together by a network of promises we make to each other, informs that work as a consultant. Quite often, though, congregations don't know the promises they've made. There are promises, I think, that exist in any community. So part of what I try to do is make the actual promises or expectations that people have explicit. And having made them explicit, to examine them, to see whether those promises are in fact consistent with the congregation's understanding of theology, of the good news, of their mission in the world. And when we identify those places where the promises they live by are in some tension with the theology and hopes for their congregation, I try to lead them in a process of readjusting and making more explicit and articulate the actual promises they hope to live by. That affects leadership, and it affects the flow of community life.
You are a wonderful preacher, and clearly the preached word is a driving force of who you are. I'll ask you what I've asked a few others. Is pulpit preaching in danger of becoming irrelevant?
I don't think pulpit preaching is in danger of becoming irrelevant unless we do the kind of preaching that makes its irrelevance important. And by that I mean we can make our preaching irrelevant. But I don't think there's anything in the nature of the publicly proclaimed word that makes it necessary for it to be irrelevant.
How can preachers keep their pulpit preaching effective in this technological age without becoming gimmicky?
Well, I'm running against the stream on that one. I really believe that this is a time for preachers to resist, to some extent, the buttressing of preaching that can occur with technology. In my own work, I'm trying to reclaim language that I think can serve the gospel well. And by that, I mean poetic language, language that can seem to overreach and overclaim in a way. But that's because I think only our large claims, our great claims, are going to get the attention of our culture. I think if we reduce our preaching to something that's manageable by technology or expressible by technology alone, we've reduced the message, the real message we have to share with our culture.
Could you give us a sense of your own sermon preparation process?
Well, I can try to give you a reflection of my sermon preparation process. Most of the time I preach from the lectionary, so the texts are chosen for me. I try really hard to live with the text without first going to commentaries or other sermons about the text I try to live with the text first and let that text suggest questions to me, make claims to me, and I try to find words and images for those claims and questions, and then I go look for either support or revision of what I think I've heard based on commentaries and other preachers. I tend to write several drafts of the sermons that I end up preaching simply because I'm trying to get the words right. And often, even after I've preached, think, I wish I'd had more time to get the words right.
Well, and I was going to ask you about that. As a pastor, obviously, sometimes the realities of being a pastor interfere with what our process what we would want it to be. What do you do in such cases?
Well, Sunday's always coming.
Yeah.
So often Sunday is there and it's time to preach. And that's why it's important to me to live with the text first, so that what I take to the pulpit, even if I've not had the chance to prepare, is my own hearing of the text and not my own hearing of others who have heard the text. The reality is there are some weeks when that's all I get done, is to hear the text and try to say what I've heard without much more time to refine it. But that's why I try to start with hearing the text.
Well, Guy, we appreciate it very much. Thanks for letting us get to know you a little better.
Thank you, Peter. I've enjoyed it.